Welcome back to our Leadership Hour on Connecting Faith. My final interview is with leadership coach and social innovator Jason Jagard. Jason is founding partner of Novus Global, an elite executive coaching firm for individuals and companies who are looking to achieve maximum performance. I had a chance to sit down with Jason at the Fuel Leadership Conference. Jason, what advice do you tend to give for someone who is getting into an area of leadership for the first time?
That's a great question. I've never been asked that question before. So somebody, one is, I suppose, not to be coy about it, but I don't know, so how old are these people? Because usually you get into leadership about as soon as you learn how to talk and walk.
Yes, but it seems like that's counterintuitive, that you should actually have done something for a while before you become a leader.
Yeah.
But it seems like now we're training people before they're even ready to become leaders on how to become leaders.
Yeah, well, that's what's fun about it. So you know, if you want to use a standard John Maxwellian definition of leadership, it's influence. So you're actually a leader before you're born because you're impacting your parents. Yeah. So my life, to the degree that I have any leadership skills at all, and I don't know necessarily that I do, I'm the beneficiary of when I was 11, 10, 12, both in a school and a church, I was told that I was a leader, and I was invited to own my influence from a very, very, very young age. And while sometimes I resented that, for the most part, I really appreciated, especially in retrospect, appreciated adults inviting me as a 10-year-old to look at how I'm impacting the world. And so even in my work, so, you know, as an executive coach, we're experimenting with how young can you go and develop and offer the same kind of executive coaching that we offer CEOs to young people. Like, for example, right now we're working with a university in another state, and we're going to offer the exact same kind of executive coaching process that we offer for Fortune 500 CEOs to incoming freshmen who are the first in their families to go to college. And we're going to see what happens.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's going to be fun, right? Because no one's ever really done that before. Like, no one's ever offered we do a very specific kind of high-end coaching. No one's ever really put it in the water with people whose brains aren't done developing yet. And so we want to, even like some of the things we're talking about now, is there some inner-city programs we're connected to in Los Angeles, and we want to, like, see what happens if we give it to someone who's 15 years old, like a 15-year-old inner-city kid. What could they do if we gave them the same kind of ideological framework that we give to CEOs?
Well, and it does seem, I have a 14-year-old, and mm-hmm. he's just in that point where at peer leadership or maybe in his school, they are testing them, and they're giving them either a spiritual gifts test or a strength finder, and that is the time when they say, oh, wait a minute, maybe I am a leader.
Yeah.
And so what can you do with that at that age? Because for a lot of them, it's the first time they've heard this.
Totally. And again, I think that's unfortunate. One thing that churches do implicitly, they don't usually say that word. So, like, churches don't systematically teach that children are leaders, but they do implicitly treat them like leaders, which is really interesting. Like, you know, like, and this is what's unique, even if you're an atheist or an agnostic, to look at the anthropological nature of a 501c3 faith-based organization like a church. They they bring kids up, and the kids give testimonies on stage, and they, like, oftentimes kids have, like, a kid worship Sunday, and, like, 10-year-olds are, like, leading adults and singing music or whatever. That's not normal. In other spaces, you know, like, if you, I have my atheist and agnostic friends in Los Angeles, they lament that there's not something like that for their children. And they will tell me, Jason, I don't buy any of the religion stuff, but I'm going to take my kids to church because that's where they're going to learn how to be leaders, which is really interesting.
Interesting.
Right? But to answer your question, the short answer is I don't really know. But if I'm going to just take a swing at answering it, I would say I would really love to create spaces for young people, and by young people I mean under the age of 18, to begin creating a space for them to process out loud the way they wish the world was that's not. Oh. In our work, vision is what unleashes leadership, not the other way around. So it's not like, hey, I'm a leader, now what do I do? It's more like saying, hey, in what ways do you wish your family was different? In what ways do you wish your classroom was different? In what ways what do you wish was happening at your school that's not happening? And then that question will unveil, in our work, what we call complaints. Like, it'll invite people to complain, and we love complaints. Like, we don't love complaining as, like, a lifestyle, but we love complaints because embedded in the complaint is a latent vision.
Sure.
Right? Like, it's cold outside. That's a complaint. Okay, great. So the vision is, I wish I had a coat. And then you can, like, go get a job to buy a coat or ask your parents to give you a coat or whatever, right? And so if you can, and I think that's one thing that churches and schools and educational processes and companies don't do a good job of. It's like becoming vision incubators and watching to see what flicks of leadership come out of that as people attempt to achieve the vision.
Well, it also seems like we need to give the young people the power to actually create change.
Yeah.
To not just have an idea, but say, hey, let's give that idea a chance.
Yeah, I like that. On the surface, I would totally agree with you. Like giving them the power authority. I kind of have an anti-authoritarian streak in me. And so I like reminding students that if they feel disempowered, they've bought into a mythology of who they are as human beings. And so part of the work is holding space to remind people that they are powerful, right? Like I don't, as a teacher or as a boss or whoever, I don't need to give my employees power. They already have power, and they can quit, and that's an expression of their power. Or they could, you know, like sue the company. That's an expression of their power, right? That people, human beings, have innate power. The question is how are they using it? And the way most people, and this is important, the way most people choose to use their power is by convincing themselves that they're powerless. And that is one of the biggest lies people tell themselves, and they don't even realize they do it. It becomes like white noise. Like a disempowered mindset is prevalent in our society, and it's worse in other countries. Like America has a pretty disempowered stance, and even in other countries it's way, way, way worse. And so part of the job of creating powerful leadership environments is holding space to remind people not only are they powerful, but how they're choosing to use it, which is essentially like a self-neutering that most people do.
Well, one of the things that you write about along that same line is that leaders can find power in creating this community, and you call it a culture of initiative.
Yeah.
Talk more about that.
Yeah, well, and we were talking about this before we hit record. It's the idea, it's one thing. Have you ever noticed when you try to change a system? I don't know if you ever tried to change a family or a marriage or a company or a church or a team or whatever, how hard it is.
Mm-hmm.
There's like these invisible forces at play, and what most people don't realize is that there's in every human being, and consequently every human system, there's a culture of homeostasis that reacts against change, both positive and negative. In fact, your body doesn't differentiate between positive and negative change, which is why you experience grief when you have a baby or you experience grief when you win the lottery. These are positive things, but your body doesn't know that. All it knows is that something's different, and so there's pain there. And so built into our systems is keeping things the same. So whenever you're trying to enact change in a system, you're fighting against the current of the organizational system. So the object of the game is then to change the way people relate to change and change the conversation. The way that we articulate that is through like a culture of initiative. So it's not just enough for you to take initiative. It's not just like if you're a kid in a family or if you're a wife or a husband in a family, it's not just enough for you to take initiative. You actually have to invite the system into a conversation around initiative and then invite and then have new commitments that create that.
So you work a lot with CEOs.
Yes.
And with your Novus Global.
Yes.
Executives who are learning to lead well.
Yeah.
So how do you teach them to gain this culture to say, I have influence, now what am I going to do with that influence? How do you work that around?
Yeah, well, the first step in our work is holding space for people to acknowledge how they're currently using their influence. And not to be redundant, but most people use their influence to convince people they're not influential, especially in the church, by the way. Like, I work with so many.
What's an example of that?
Yeah, so I was working with a client. They're an NFL player, and they were raised in the church and all this kind of stuff. And we were talking, and they're really struggling to have the degree of success that they want. And in the game, and we were talking about this, and he kept apologizing a lot. He was using mitigating language a lot. He was like, try, sort of, maybe, kind of. He would apologize for things, like if he interrupted me, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, he's very apologetic. And I said to him, why is it you think that you do that? And he goes, well, I don't want to be accused of being arrogant. And I said, well, is it possible that there's something worse than being accused of being arrogant? Is living your life in a way to where no one could ever accuse you of that, which is in its own form of arrogance. And I asked him where he thought that came from, and he goes, well, from my Christian upbringing, like, you know, you're not supposed to be arrogant. And I said, yeah, but people accusing you of being arrogant and being arrogant are not the same thing. And this is maybe somewhat controversial, but it's my personal opinion that the accusation of arrogance is the accusation of the weak. Mm-hmm. That when we see people live their lives in a powerful, meaningful way. We will accuse them of arrogance when really they're just, it takes more humility to do something significant than it does to accuse people who are doing something significant of being arrogant. And in Australia, I do a lot of my work is in Australia. They have a saying called cutting up the tall poppies, which is where, like, if a person in Australia grows to prominence, the culture around them conspires against them to bring them down. It's bad in Australia. It's even worse in Germany, for obvious reasons. Like in World War II, they had some bad experiences with people rising to power. And that happens in America too. It happens in churches, like where it's not okay to be ambitious. It's not okay. And the scriptures never criticize ambition. The scriptures only criticize selfish ambition. And I think we threw the baby out with the bathwater, and we thought we have decried ambition, because ambitious people are harder to control, versus building character and ambition into people and setting them loose to make the world a better place.
So how do you create that change? Is it making the awareness that this is actually happening,
yeah,
that those who are maybe not living to their full potential because they think that they're not supposed to?
Yeah, there's two ways to go about it, depending on how nice you want to be. So the nice, the sugar-coated way, not in a bad way, but like oftentimes it's inviting people to step into a vision conversation, like wave a magic wand, what would you want to see happening in your life that's not currently happening? And then that'll reveal complaints, limiting thoughts, the things that are getting in their own way. Because the reality is everyone's life works exactly where they want it to, which I know sounds crazy, but that's like the fundamental operating belief of our work. So that's part of it, is inviting people into a visional space. The other part of it is really inviting people to notice that they are massively underselling themselves. It's a dogma of our work that every leader's two greatest leaders. Let me back up. Oftentimes when we do workshops or whatever, we invite leaders to write down what their greatest leadership challenges are. Like, write down your top three greatest leadership challenges. And if you're listening to this, you can I wonder what my top three greatest leadership challenges are. And some people have a really hard time answering them, which means one of their leadership challenges is they don't know what their leadership challenges are, right? And then we talk about it, and 99% of the time, what a person thinks their greatest leadership challenges are not their greatest leadership challenges. It's the tip of the iceberg, not the iceberg. Every leader's two greatest leadership challenges is that they drastically underestimate their own leadership potential, and they drastically underestimate the leadership potential of their teams. And that's it. That's the ball game. And if you can help a person, if you can hold space for a person to begin getting curious about, I wonder how I underestimate my own leadership potential, then that's a really powerful space to begin leading a person forward and creating cultures. If you can imagine, if you can create a culture where they have this fierce belief that in any given moment they are totally underestimating themselves and they're underestimating the teams they lead, it's a game changer.
I imagine that as you're talking about that, I think about that like for my children,
yes,
or for the people that I've led, that if,
yes,
they had that attitude, that what they could accomplish,
yep,
it would change the way that they operated every day.
Totally, totally. And whenever you talk to a leader and you ask them, hey, why isn't your company doing better? They're gonna talk about how bad their team is, always. And that reveals what they think their team's capable of, right? And they may be right that their team won't change, but that's not because their team's not capable of change. It's because their team's not committed to change. And if you have someone on your team that's not committed to change, then you need to start a process by which you can remove them from their team. And if you're, by the way, if you're listening to this and you're not committed to change, you should get fired. Like, that's just, it's totally up to you. And a person who is committed to change, fiercely committed to change, will always be marketable. They may not always have a job at the company they have now, but they'll always have a job. Because people who are committed to change are always growing, and they're always inviting other people to grow, and they're indispensable.
You know, you mentioned something about how people unintentionally create this life that they weren't trying to live.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit more about that and,
yeah,
how we can maybe steer away from doing that. How does that happen?
Yeah, well, the first thing is, and I feel like I keep rephrasing the question, everybody's life works the way they want it to. I guess the unintentional part is they don't realize that their payoffs are the way their lives are. So like every person is making as much money as they want to. Every person is, and that's true of me, right? So I make a certain amount of income right now. I'm the CEO of a company. I'm doing all right. But like, it's not like I've like maxed out my earning potential. And if you were to ask me right now, Jason, what's stopping you from making more money? It's me. Like have you seen the memes, Beyonce has the same amount of time in her,
yes,
day as you do. And I love that meme. And then there's counter memes to that. It's like, well, Beyonce has a staff of 100 and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, yeah, because that's how Beyonce set it up. She wasn't born with a staff of 100. She, the only difference between me and Beyonce, other than talent, is she thinks differently than I do. Her psychology is different. And her husband is similar, like Jay-Z. You know, one of my favorite quotes about him is he says, I'm not a businessman. I'm a business, man. Hmm. And he understand his he thinks differently about money, and consequently he gets to be 10 times, maybe 100 times more generous than I am. You know, so it's not just about acclimation. It's about, I want to be a funnel of stewardship into the world through the blessing of God. And if I can't learn to think like Beyonce, then I'll never achieve what God has set out for me to achieve. And the thing is about that is anybody can learn to think differently. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't have to change my gender or my ethnicity or my background or my heritage or anything like that in order to step into what God has for me. All I have to do is begin thinking in the way that God has designed me to think.
Thanks so much for listening to Connecting Faith. For more information on any of the guests we had on today, head to our website at myfaithradio.com and click on Connecting Faith. Have a great weekend.